What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal tug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Pōpongi mānia, alii, no ia e Māori and Goodfellow Morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Hope you had a great weekend. Thanks for tuning into today's show. I'm your host, Aggie DuBois, and coming up, controversy continues to shroud Fiji's anti-corruption watchdog. More bodies are being recovered from PNG's worst maritime disaster, and we get the latest on how our Pacific teams are faring at this year's Commonwealth Games. More on those stories shortly, but before we begin, we'd like to acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. So with that, korapua, thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We start in Fiji, where controversy continues to shroud the country's anti-corruption watchdog. Last week, the Fiji Independent Commission Against Corruption, or FICAC, dropped charges against suspended Director of Public Prosecutions, Christopher Pride, after years of legal action. And by the end of the week, FICAC suffered another legal blow, with the High Court issuing a permanent stay in its case against former journalist and political commentator Charlie Charters. Mr. Charters was accused of aiding and abetting a FICAC officer to unlawfully publish official information on his Facebook account. Well, joining us this morning from Fiji is the man himself, Charlie Charters. With that, I say yandere, Charlie.
Yandere naka.
Yeah, thank you for joining us this morning. First of all, are you relieved that the High Court chose to issue a permanent stay in this matter?
I'm relieved. I mean, I have to say, when I was arrested and detained and then charged, I really didn't kind of understand what was going on. And when I got the news on Friday, I also really didn't kind of understand what was going on. Mm. I was very happy, obviously, because after 5-6 months, it really does kind of wear down on you. I was very grateful that the system, you know, appears to work. And this, you know, huge prosecutorial overreach was corrected in the High Court. So yeah, I'm happy, but frankly, like a lot of people in Fiji, I'm kind of baffled that this even happened and went as far as it did.
Yeah. Before we get into all of that, can I ask though, Mr. Charters, what did the judge actually say about this case?
Well, the judge was very critical, basically, of 4 points relating to my kind of specific prosecution. The detention at Nandi Airport, the interview that took place, what happened to me in the 2 days that I was incarcerated in Suva, and then the charging decision. He basically found that my rights were violated on a number of different levels, that their interest in prosecuting me was basically an infringement of my right to express my opinions under the Constitution. Mm. They use this phrase, foredoomed to fail. When I was charged, they didn't know who it was that I was supposed to have aided and abetted, and the judge said, "You need to have all of this information together, otherwise you're charging Mr. Charters basically to go on a fishing expedition within FICAC to try to find out who's breached the FICAC Act." So he was not impressed with that, and one of the elements, one of the documents that I published related to the acting FICAC commissioner hiring her brother-in-law's daughter. Mm. And that was obviously acutely embarrassing to the acting FICAC commissioner. And the High Court judge said that was such an obvious conflict of interest that the acting FICAC commissioner, if she was interested in prosecuting this, should have passed this matter over to another agency, like the Director of Public Prosecutions, to consider and not prosecute herself because of the family conflict.
Mm. And with all that to say, do you feel then you have really hard done by FICAC? I mean, if anything, does this case in your eyes show that justice does actually work in Fiji? And I know you mentioned that a little bit earlier.
Yeah, I mean, look, the system worked. I, to be honest with you, I can't pretend that it works for everybody. I was very fortunate, my wife and I, to have the resources to be able to access the best legal advice, and to really, make it clear that we weren't going quietly. That doesn't apply across the board. The most critical thing is that none of these issues are supposed to have happened. There are supposed to be these guardrails in place that all prosecutions follow to avoid exactly this issue. And for a prosecution to break through one guardrail is strange, but the High Court judge found that they actually bust through four guardrails. And the question obviously is this just something that happened to me, that I was a particular kind of nuisance, or does this happen regularly for other prosecutions that FICAC are generating? And I think when you look at the kind of batting average that FICAC has achieved over the last 12 or 13 months, you've got to say that what happened to me is probably more typical of where FICAC prosecutions end up, the sort of big ticket prosecutions, than anything else. And therefore, that represents to me a failure at a national level. It impacted me for sure. But it's really a problem for the country of Fiji that its elite law enforcement agency designed to tackle corruption seems to have such a consistently poor batting average.
I was just going to ask, what impact has this case actually had on you and your family?
It's at the end of the day, it's just a grind. It's an endless grind. And part of it is, part of the issues you don't really understand, and unless you understand also things like artificial intelligence. And I tell you why. In my travel, I have to apply for visas in a lot of instances. And I had two visa applications rejected, which I would normally expect to get. And one has to assume that when the visa application goes in, there is some sort of AI system that scrapes all of the details relating to my name, my identity, my birth date, off the internet. And they see that as far as the internet is concerned, as far as FICAC's charging history against me and what they're alleging, I'm something like the great-grandson of Ned Kelly by Jack the Ripper. And as a result of which, I'm not able to go to certain countries in the course of my business because I can't get the visa clearances. These are things that you don't understand will happen to you until you're in that process.
Right.
And it's a sign of how devastating the kind of prosecution's power is, but also how interconnected all of these information sources are globally. You make a noise in one corner of the world, everybody in all of the other corners of the world hear about it through the internet, through AI, and it's almost like a presumption of guilt.
Well then, look, at this moment you stand vindicated, Mr. Charters. FICAC wasn't able to go further with their charges. Do you think then there should be better protection of whistleblowers in Fiji?
Well, that's one of the major, impacts of the judgment was that the High Court judge was very clear about the need for a better, stronger respect by prosecuting authorities for journalists and their source, but also for confidential information. And by confidential information, one can read that as whistleblowers. The protections in Fiji for whistleblowers are very kind of haphazard, and it's a great pity, because you know, one of the frustrations I think that Fiji's going through, but it's also true in the Pacific as well, is a lot of citizens can see what is happening within their country, but for a variety of reasons, the actual state government itself, the state tools, are not taking action. Now, social media is there, and social media is, it often becomes the default form of expression by which people say, why has this person got that contract when that person is better qualified? And a lot of that ultimately comes down to finding whistleblowers who have information that then can become actionable. And if the whistleblowers are going to put themselves in harm's way, then clearly the whistleblowers are not going to come forward. And if there is corrupt action, that's going to be successful. It's going to roll on. And the countries, the Pacific, begins to kind of lose their way, essentially.
Yeah. Well, I think what's really interesting is there's been plenty of talk about constitutional reform, right? And of course, FICAC by connection. Do you then support reforming or actually getting rid of FICAC?
I'm based in Hong Kong, and obviously Hong Kong is where the original Independent Commission Against Corruption started in the early 1970s, and it's worked very well in Hong Kong. So my inclination is to support some kind of an anti-corruption agency, but it's got to be fit for purpose. And the particular issue that I always try to get people to focus on in Fiji is that FICAC is both the investigator and the prosecutor. And that isn't what happens in Hong Kong. The ICAC does the investigation, and then they refer the case file to the Department of Justice, or in Australia's case, they refer it out to the DPP. And that brings in an independent, fresh set of eyes to look at the case and to judge whether or not there's enough in the case to actually merit the constitution, to merit the prosecution. Fiji, they don't have that. Once they start an investigation, it's essentially a through train all the way to prosecution. And that can't be right. And that's, I think, probably one of the main reasons why so many of these prosecutions, these headline-grabbing prosecutions, are being initiated. And then the cases are collapsing either just before they reach court or during the court process itself.
Sorry, I did want to quickly just ask this before we wrap up, Mr. Charters. Does this then in any sense really fracture the public's confidence in FICAC? Should they at least maybe get an explanation about what went wrong?
One would think so. I mean, Fiji's in a very kind of strange position at the moment. There's 6 or 7 months to go within the time frame of this parliament. FICAC is written into the constitution. So to do any major changes will require a constitutional amendment. But as it were, there's a queue of things that this government wants to achieve with respect to that constitution, involving land, involving, you know, rearranging the electoral system. And although I would consider this important, it's not a kind of major political issue like land or the kind of voting process is. So I don't expect there will be the ability to change FICAC within its constitutional structure this side of the election. It's going to probably fall to the next parliament.
Mm. Well, look, Mr. Charters, I really appreciate you coming on the show this morning and sharing your experience. Thank you again.
Thanks.
That was Charlie Charters, former journalist, broadcaster and prominent Fijian political commentator here on Pacific Beat.
Want the latest Pacific Rugby League and Union news and interviews with stars of the game? Tune in to Nation Footy with Sam Wykes and Tini Rao Arona.
I think the big thing that's changed, Sammy, is the way you go about it now. 20, 30 years ago, you could be quite direct with a player. And now it's more about trying to guide them to the solution themselves rather than being so blunt.
Nation Footy, Monday afternoons at 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, 7 bodies recovered from one of Papua New Guinea's worst maritime disasters were transferred from New Ireland province back to East New Britain over the weekend. The ceremony took place more than a week after 2 boats sank in rough seas and the bodies were found more than 200 kilometres away. Only the two skippers of the boat survived, and families of the deceased are calling for answers from authorities. Captain Jürgen Ru from Manolos Aviation was brought in to lead the aerial search, but he says the response was too slow. He told Pacific Beat's Natasha Emick that too much time had passed before they were called in to help.
An area search should have been started a lot earlier, in my view. We were notified 24 hours after, and we got into the air 36 after the event, and we got a drift pattern from EMSA in Canberra. And yes, we found the dinghy within the drift pattern on our first run out. It was quite difficult to find an overturned dinghy because you are in very rough weather. It was 35 knots of wind. There were white caps everywhere. And finding an overturned white dinghy in amongst white caps was, it wasn't easy to find. But then we tried to look for any other debris, any other survivors, and there was nothing anywhere nearby the overturned dinghy. The next day, then in the afternoon, a body was washed ashore at Jowl Island, and I thought, no, that can't be right; it's too far away. But sure enough, it was one of the deceased 30 miles away from where the dinghy was. And then, yeah, we recovered the body from the village, and it was amazing to see how well the villagers did take care of an unknown person arriving there. They knew it was a disaster, and they knew it was likely from this disaster. It was a great moment to see them all line up and putting flowers on a body which was just wrapped in canvas, basically. And that was the first body we retrieved, and then another two more from the same island, and the rest now came from the other islands, and they were found by dinghies.
You've responded to so many incidents over the years, including the Rabaul Queen tragedy in 2012. How is this compared?
It is. It's taking its toll. But whilst the job is ongoing, I keep my emotions under control. But once the job is finished and we settle down, that's the time you realize that this is the sister of someone and the wife of someone and so forth. And then it sets in a bit. But it's a tough one. Yeah.
I saw the governor in East New Britain gave you some traditional shell money to say thank you. What has this work meant to you, helping families bring their loved ones home over the last few days?
Well, I lived in Rabaul for many years before I moved my operation also to Lae, and I'm very well connected to everyone in Rabaul. People know me, I know them, and we have one big family. And what I actually did yesterday was on the coffin was an A4 framed letter from the New Ireland Provincial Health Authority sending their condolences to the East New Britain Health Authority.
Because that's the other thing, right? The East New Britain Health Authority, it's a tragedy that hits very close to home because some of the people involved were employees and work side by side with the people who are probably receiving them right now, right?
Absolutely. Even the nurse I've had on board, when I do a search and rescue, I always have a nurse with me, obviously. If we find someone, give them first aid. And my nurse also realized that she was recovering human remains of very close friends of hers when she was previously working at Nonga. And it's a tough one.
Besides the rough seas, what other challenges have there been in this recovery?
The other problem we have here also is that the provincial disaster offices are not prepared for any disasters. There are no proper body bags. There's no PPE. There's nothing. And, when the disaster like this happens and they start looking for body bags in this shop and that shop, and the first body bags we received from them, they didn't hold body liquid. So it's been very challenging to work in an environment where there's no disaster preparedness.
I imagine that's also important for maintaining the dignity of the deceased, as well as ensuring proper hygiene for those handling the remains, right?
Correct. So I prefer now for the deceased to go into the morgue here in Kavieng first, and they can assess, they can properly prepare the deceased to go into the aviation-approved coffin, and then from the aviation-approved coffin, then we take them into Nonga now.
And that there is Captain Jürgen Ru from Manolos Aviation speaking with Natasha Emick. right, we go to South Australia now, where the Pacific Island community came together in Adelaide over the weekend for a Melanesian lullaby to bid farewell to cultural objects. As the largest display of Pacific Island artefacts in the Southern Hemisphere is hibernated for restoration. The ABC's Peter Doherty was there and filed the story.
Papua New Guinean cultural leader Wazzo Matthews addresses two crocodile artefacts at the South Australian Museum.
I was just talking to them and reassuring them, more or less, that they're going to be safe.
These wooden crocodiles and more than 2,500 other artefacts will be retired to an off-site storage as the South Australian Museum begins a years-long restoration project of its Pacific Island collection. Wazzo and a group of representatives from other Pacific nations lay a covering over the crocodiles, symbolically putting them and the other objects to sleep. The museum has assured community the Pacific Cultures Collection will return in coming years, but there is no set date. Here's Wazzo again.
But because it's in a foreign land and I don't know what's going to happen to it, and I think not knowing the future of it, that makes me sad that they're going to put it to rest today.
The Papua New Guinean community, along with other Pacific Islanders, are performing traditional songs and dances to send off the collection. Fred Ovia from the Pacific Islands Council of South Australia took part in the ceremony.
I take my Pacific Islands Council of South Australia hat off and I put my PNG hat on. And so I put the hat on that belongs to the southern part of Papua New Guinea. Our cultures are different, our languages are different, so much so that we've got over 800 languages in PNG.
Fred Ovia says he regularly visits the gallery with his grandchildren and will miss it.
You can't help but feel the history behind it. You know, who built it? What was he like? What was she like? And I had a clay pot in my hands, and I don't know how old that clay pot is. But holding that clay pot was not just holding a clay pot. It was feeling the history behind that clay pot. Who built this? Who made this, you know? Was she a young person? Was she an old? Was she a widow? Was she in need? Was she somebody that was well off? Was she, you know, all of these things you can't help but feel when you're holding it. And so that, you know, creates this emotion in me about knowing that something that comes from where I come from landed here in Australia. How it came, that's a whole different story.
But he says the conservation project is important for the next generation.
Having it preserved so that someone else, you know, 10, 20 years from now, when we're all gone, you know, the younger generation can come and still continue to enjoy these things.
Museum Director Samantha Hamilton says some of the objects have been on display for decades and need to be rested.
So our responsibility is to protect and preserve collections for future generations. And our responsibility lies in understanding the materials and their needs. And so a lot of these materials have been on display for a few decades now. I'm not sure if people are aware, but what happens in the museum world, we have this statistic where we say 99% of our collections are in storage, and often the public is only able to see a very small portion. So that's what's happened in this display.
The South Australian Museum houses the largest Melanesian display in the Southern Hemisphere. But most of the artefacts come from just one country, Papua New Guinea, spanning the period from the late 19th century until the First World War. The museum says there are hundreds more artefacts in storage, and in the future it hopes to create a display that represents more of the Pacific nations, as Samantha Hamilton explains.
This is the exciting piece of work that I'm really looking forward to doing, is to really go out to the community and look at that region holistically and make sure that we have representation from across the region.
During the process, the collection will be digitalised in 3D. The space will be used for travelling ticketed exhibitions in the meantime, but the museum says it will also put on pop-up shows for the Pacific Cultures Gallery. Fred Ovia agrees the display needs to be refreshed.
Freshening it is always a good thing. Yeah, but we'd like to see the whole exhibition, we'd like to see the gallery have representation of Papua New Guinea because of the history behind Australia, Papua New Guinea.
The community will be involved in selecting items from the museum's vast collection to display and tell new stories in the years to come. For now, it's time for the artefacts to sleep.
And that is Peter Doherty reporting from Adelaide with that story. All right, to sport now, where unfortunately a historic day for Fiji and rugby didn't have the happy ending everyone involved in the sport in Fiji was hoping for. Now, the first ever Super Rugby Grand Final on Fijian soil ended in defeat for the Drua women's team as they went down 34-17 to the Waratahs. The New South Wales team took command in the first half while the Drua failed to register a score until the hour mark, and a late rally proved to be too little too late. Calling the game, though, for FBC was the voice of Fiji. Fijian rugby, Satish Narain, who joins us now on Pacific Beat. With that, Yandra, Satish.
Yandra Vinaka.
Yeah, thanks for joining. My gosh, must say, what went wrong for the Drua? I mean, with 11 players making their grand final debut, did the pressure maybe of playing at home get to them in the end?
Oh, 100%. I think, you know, like they saved the worst for the last. It's a bad thing to say, but yeah, that's what happened. They were really good during the season in round play to be minor premiers, and then a big, massive shift in that semi-final to win over the Queensland Reds. And, you know, hopes were so high. The nation was behind the Fijian Drua women. Even the Prime Minister was there in the semi-final, and he was also present for the final. The whole nation, big crowd, 4,000 plus people in a beautiful bar. But, you know, in the rugby field, it just didn't happen for the Fijian Drua. Unfortunate.
Well, that's definitely a positive. We always know our people show up when we're playing. But so what are some other positives the Drua can take from this season?
I think the Drua, you know, the biggest thing that I think they've done is I saw a lot of young girls come out to the rugby on Saturday. They were waving flags. So they've inspired a generation. That's a big thing as far as our young people are concerned in the country. Fiji is facing a lot of issues at the moment with young people involved in drugs and other petty crimes. And when they look up to inspirational rugby players like what the Fijian Drua women did over the last few weeks in the Super W competition, you know, they get inspired. They want to put on the boots. They want to put on the rugby shorts in the jersey and get out and play over there. That's huge. That cannot be measured in the money terms. So I think they've done a lot. And and for the players themselves, I think they've got two big rugby test matches to look forward to next week and the following week against top-rated South Africa. So they're carrots at the end of this. It's not the end of the world, but you know, a lot of people were disappointed after that result on Saturday.
Well, what do you think Satish needs to improve then for next time round?
I think, you know, just too much emotions, maybe. You know, the week ahead of the final, the build-up, everybody was talking about how this was so, you know, a historic moment, historic in the sense that the grand final was coming home and everyone was saying, you know, let's bring it home and, you know, keep the trophy here and things like that. And, you know, social media played a big part, I think, because, you know, it was all plastered over every dog and its owner had something to say about it. And, you know, the girls read that, the girls watch videos, and I think it affected them somehow because they were not in the game for about 25, 30 minutes. And like you mentioned earlier, you know, they did come back. They scored three tries in the second half, a little too late. But I think, you know, a lot of things to take care of. But, you know, historic moment, you know, home grand final for the first time. They've promised at the end of the game, you know, the post-match interviews, we're going to bring another home grand final home. So I think, you know, those are the positives that you can take. You know, they went down in one, but they want to come back stronger next time. And that's the beauty about it.
Well, Satish, what about the Super Rugby competition, you know, as a whole? Do you think it's time to maybe make the season longer, or like, should each team be playing each other twice?
Oh, you know, that would be fantastic. I think women's rugby is on the rise. in the Pacific, in the Oceania, and, you know, how Australia is, you know, building things up. And, you know, all thanks to the Australian government and the Pacific All Sports and everyone involved, the Fijian Drua and the Fijian Rugby, to have the Fijian Drua women, you know, provide them a platform, provide them a pathway, a journey to get into this competition. It happened first in 2022. It's grown since then. And you know, I agree with you 100%. If they can play a home and away, make a double round and semi-finals and final, you know, there'll be a little bit more rugby for the women, more growth, you know, more exposure and good for the sport. That's what I think. One thing, you know, if they get the sponsors backing, if they get the money, they can do that. That'll be wonderful.
Of course. Well, how about adding more sides, though? Do you think, like, maybe the likes of the combined Samoa Tonga team or maybe Benita Pasifika, perhaps? What are your thoughts around this?
I think that is brilliant. You know, you just nailed it. You know, we've got the Fijian Drua playing. Our near neighbours, Samoa, Tonga, the likes of Cook Islands and a few others, you know, like, why can't we make a combined Pacific side? Be like the Moana Pacifica and, you know, base them in Australia or something and then have them in. Our women in the Pacific need those opportunities. And you know, again, wonderful that Australia is laying the platform, giving us that opportunity to show the skills and show what the Pacific women can do in rugby and in any other sport for that matter, but in rugby we're talking about at the moment. So, you know, 100% back that idea. I would love to see a combined Pacific side where we have women from Samoa, Tonga, Cook Islands and any other nation, Niue or any other place, to join into that team and become an extra side. That will be fantastic.
Yeah, I'm sure something we can all definitely back. But look, Satish, really appreciate your time coming on the show this morning. Vinaka.
Vinaka Vakalevu, have a good day.
You too. That is FBC rugby commentator Satish Narain with his thoughts there on where the women's super rugby competition might go next. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Continuing with sport, Australia is leading the charge at the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow with 31 medals, followed by England and Scotland. No Pacific countries have yet to win a medal, but there's been some impressive performances, including Fijian swimmer David Tolu Young, who made history by qualifying for the 50-metre freestyle final. Well, joining us from Glasgow is Jemenia Haro from WINS, ABC International Women's in News and Sports Mentoring Programme. With that, I say good morning, Jemenia.
Good morning and good night here all the way from Glasgow. Now, I'm just trying to add on what you just said. I am happy to tell you that we finally medaled today for the Pacific Islands.
All right. And where did we tally in?
Oh, so it's Papua New Guinea's Moria Baru. He won a bronze medal in the men's 65 kg division weightlifting category.
Wow, that is some good news to hear, Jemenia. And, of course, it has been a packed weekend there in Glasgow. I suppose, what has been some other big stories involving our Pacific athletes over the last few days?
Oh, it's been really hectic this last 3 days here in Glasgow. The weather is actually cold. I'm not sure if the athletes have been, they've already acclimatized, but there's a lot of action going on for boxing. A lot of our Pacific Islanders have sent boxing athletes to compete here. So, good news, Team Fiji's Jasmine Dauna Kama, she just qualified for the quarterfinals. An hour before, I went over to the weightlifting area to watch Moria Baru win bronze medal for Papua New Guinea. So, some good results, apart from David Toluyan finishing seventh in the finals for the men's freestyle, I believe. Just trying to confirm that. But yeah, some good results for our Pacific athletes.
Of course. And are there any sort of other Pacific competitors that you feel that are going to be standing out soon? What are we expecting to see in any games coming up?
So, apart from the main athletes that I've called, I was really impressed with 18-year-old Nauru athlete, weightlifter Jobet Dre, I'm not sure if I get her name correct, but her name's Jobet. She was a few kilos short from medaling for her country, Nauru. She fell few kilos short in total, but she was really it was a really impressive record for someone her age, given that she had set a Oceania record in the Oceania Weightlifting Champs a few months back before coming to her first Commonwealth Games and breaking that record here in her first Commonwealth Games. So really impressive for a young athlete at her age, competing in the women's 48 kg division. Apart from that, we have the 3x3 basketball going on, and I am really impressed with the Tongan women who are on debut, apart from Fiji and Papua New Guinea, all three teams on debut. And the Tongan women have so far registered 2 wins in their pool matches as of yesterday.
That is some great news to hear. Jamania, any sort of maybe emotional moments, upsets, or just breakthrough performances that you think have captured attention around the Pacific teams?
Oh, yes, there's a lot of heartbreak going on with the results that we've seen over the last 3 days. Some results did not come in the athlete's way and a bit disappointing. But one thing that really stood out for me in these last 3 days is seeing how the Pacific has come together, whichever athlete that competes. All the Pacific Islanders, they team up regardless of where they come from to go and support that particular athlete or team just to make numbers and show that they are still here, they can compete at this level.
Well, looking ahead then for the next 24 to 48 hours, Jamania, again, for our Pacific audiences, who should they be watching closely or could be in contention for medals?
In boxing, we have obviously the Fijian boxer Jasmine Dauna Kamakama, as well as new and heavyweight boxer Duken Williams. He was the bronze medal in the last Commonwealth Games, so he's the one to look out for as well in boxing. Apart from that, we have athletics starting tomorrow, which is 7 p.m. time in the Australia Eastern Standard Time. So athletics starts at, tomorrow, Monday, which is, 7 p.m. at your end. But apart from that, we have lawn bowls that's still going. Fiji singles player Pranish Prasad, he's really doing well in the singles, apart from our doubles, our women's pairs and men's singles. And all these are a lot of our Pacific teams playing lawn bowls in this event. We have weightlifting. We have Nauru and weightlifters to look out for. Obviously, Nauru has done really well at the Commonwealth Games and especially in weightlifting. So a couple of the athletes will be competing and those are the athletes to look out for. And as well as our Olympian Papua New Guinea weightlifter, Dika Toa, who will be making another appearance tomorrow in her weight division as of tomorrow afternoon.
Which is what we will be looking forward to. I suppose, Jamania, apart from the cold, how is Glasgow?
Oh, it's really cold, but really welcoming, especially for the people here. They're really loving and really welcoming and very helpful, as new people to their country. They've been really helpful trying to get us to where we want to go, when we need help and everything. Like, they're really helpful in whatever ways they can, just making sure that we're okay and we need everything. So, really good.
I do want to just ask if you do know a little bit more about, that PNG winner with the bronze medal in the weightlifting, Baru. What more do we know about him?
So Moria Baru is one of our top Pacific weightlifters in the Pacific. He's a gold medalist at the Pacific Games. His highest achievement at the Commonwealth Games was the Birmingham Games last year, which was the silver medal in the same category. This year, he tried to break that record but fell a few kilos short, but he is still grateful that he medaled for Papua New Guinea and especially for the Pacific because he is the first Pacific Islander to win a medal. So he said regardless of the colour, he's really grateful. And this Commonwealth Games, he said, is a very special one because he had the opportunity to compete alongside his younger brother who finished 6th in the men's 60 kg division.
Wow, that's some really great news to hear. So thank you very much for sharing that. Jamania, it is just great to catch up with you. Hopefully we can still keep in touch with you right throughout the course of the Commonwealth Games. But thank you again.
Thank you so much. And I wish all the Pacific Islanders the best of luck in the remaining days to come.
Absolutely. That is Jamania Haro from WINS, ABC International Women in News and Sports.
What's up, ABC Radio Australia listeners? I'm Sosafina Formoli, and I want you to come hang with me for On The Record, your weekly deep dive into the music that moves the Pacific. We'll talk about the big tracks that inspire your favourite Pacific music artists and the real stories behind them. Plus, we'll uncover some gems that you might not know yet, keeping the heart of the Pacific alive and thumping. Catch On The Record Mondays at 3 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Me Takimata, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, for Pacific nations on the front line of climate disasters, accurate weather data can save lives. But getting vital monitoring equipment into the region is often slow and expensive, with imported weather stations taking months to arrive. Now, Vanuatu is trying a different approach. The country's Meteorological and Geohazards Department is training local technicians to design and build automatic weather stations using 3D printing technology. Director Levu Antvalo told our reporter in Vanuatu the move could make the country faster, cheaper and more self-reliant when it comes to monitoring extreme weather.
So we use 3D printers to create AWS machines or the equipments we use in automatic weather stations to monitor temperature, wind, humidity, soil temperature, and all those parameters that we monitor, our technicians can now produce or create these machines or the particular parameter sensors in country, so that it saves waiting time for any machine that we order overseas to get to Vanuatu. It takes nearly 2 to 3 months, but with this upskilling that they're getting, they can now produce these instruments in country, deployed in just within a month.
But from the period that it will take to get one into the country, why is it important that the department engage in upskilling the technicians?
It is important to upskill the technicians because in the Met world, data is very important. Knowing directly the specifications of instruments that you need to produce is important, and making sure it's calibrated. That means it doesn't give you garbage data. It has to give you real and good data. So there's a certain criteria before they deploy these particular machines that they produce. They have, once it's produced, they have to go through calibration procedures. And once it fits the standards that is spelled out by WMO, then those instruments are deployed. But this is for the first time we're having this training. And hopefully after the 2 weeks, we'll be able to deploy 22. AWS full setup of an AWS station, and then we should be able to deploy that to our outer stations.
How many stations are out there?
We have 24, six main ones at our main airport, sorry, seven, Sola, Saratamata, Pekoa, Norsup, and Lamap, and then we have Powellville and Whitegrass and Analcohat in Anaichon. But there are other climatological stations set up around our islands to help the agriculture sector.
Why is it important for us to have those machines in the country?
Yeah, it is important to have these printing machines in the country because, as I've told you, cost-wise, very, very expensive. Logistic-wise, downtime to wait for these things takes 2 to 3 months, and we cannot wait for that because we know Vanuatu is in a crossroad for all the disasters. We have volcano, we have tropical cyclone, now we're going through El Nino. And having this capability of producing these automatic weather stations in country should help us, you know, go on the spot, find a location and start monitoring the environmental conditions of that particular place pertaining to any, should a community is experiencing a particular extreme weather or a particular extreme climate event, we can print these machines, deploy it, and at the same time it sends the information to us so that we can continuously and closely monitor the situations on ground.
And that's Levon Tfano, Director of Vanuatu Meteorological Hydrological Services, speaking to ABC's reporter in Vanuatu, Lily Rose Wildwell. Time to take a look back at one of our main stories today. Fiji's corruption watchdog, FICAC, has dropped charges against suspended Director of Public Prosecutions, Christopher Pride, who says a flawed process is resulting in failed prosecutions.
Probably one of the main reasons so many of these prosecutions, these headline-grabbing prosecutions, are being initiated, and then the cases are collapsing.
You can find those stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. And remember, we are across our social media platforms. You can check us out on Facebook or Instagram. Our team will be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. But you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it is Nita Daily, which I'll be able to catch up with the boys at the half-hour mark. Until next time, Otua. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.